Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on billions for the bankers right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population, and the top tax rate was only 7%. But today, of course, the fears of many of those early proponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to more than 60%. And by the time Franklin Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at every level. This year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when we compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. You know, the income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. Now, that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's the place for you to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it doesn't cost you anything. It's free. Now, our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc. That's for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about billions for the bankers, and I've given you a little background here as to what this is leading up to, and the final analysis here is that the political parties here in the United States have both been taken over by the banking interests. There's actually four of these professional groups that are involved in the takeover of our economy, of our society, of our government. Number one in the pecking order here are the bankers. So if you want to write this down, put down the bankers, number one. Number two is the lawyers. These are the people that make our laws, the lawyers. Number three are the preachers. They get 501c3 tax exemption, and they're the people that are out here in the pulpits telling you people that you ought to obey your civil law government. Read Romans 13, 1 through 6. They will admonish. I talked to you about that last week. I said, well, that's true. Romans 13 is true, accurate, and correct. It's good law. But it's not all of the law on the subject matter of law as it relates to deciding should I practice the law of Texas or should I practice the law of God. And the answer is we should be practicing the law of God first and the law of Texas second. We don't do that. We practice the law of Texas first and the law of God second. And as a result of that, we've gotten a result. And then if you're satisfied with the result, stick with the program. If you're not, then it's time to change. So we got the bankers, the lawyers, the preachers, and now we've got the businessmen. And these businessmen over here are the people that are the top echelons that come out of our Harvard Law School, or not Law School, Business School, and Princeton and Yale and, you know, these Ivy League schools. And they run our big multinational corporations. They run our banks. They run our politics. These are the people that run the Boeing Aircraft Company and Lockheed and Bill Gates over here, you know, at Microsoft. These are the people that are in the business world. These are the people that are moving the Dell Computer Company to China. Now, these lawyers over here, primarily, if you'll go into your legislature, these people are politicians. And it's not the lawyer down here that's doing business on the street corner. And he's a whore, all right, but he's doing business out here in a more conventional manner. That's conventional whoredom. The lawyers that run for political office, those are the whores that are causing us the problem and giving us VD. See, those are the guys that are making our laws for us. You know, people like Ted Kennedy. He was one of them. He was a lawyer. Our president, Barack Obama, is a lawyer. And we've elected these lawyers. And last week, I pointed you to Leviticus chapter 11. Remember that, not Leviticus, it was Luke. Luke chapter 11. Hey, you Christians can read that. It's in the New Testament. Here's what Jesus thought of preachers and lawyers. And he told you very plainly. Now, these lawyers are making these laws. They're taking the bribes from the businessmen, and they're making the laws that the businessmen want, which is resulting in the outcome that we're witnessing, and that is the deindustrialization of America. And there's a group of people that are behind the lawyers, behind the preachers, and behind the businessmen, and those are the bankers. Bankers. And then a guy by the name of Sheldon Emery, back in 1982, he ran a church. He was a religious guy. He's dead now, but he wrote a little booklet here, and it's called Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People by Sheldon Emery. Printed back in 1982. You might be able to get a copy of it from Lord's Covenant Church, America's Promise Broadcast, Post Office Box 5334, Phoenix, Arizona, 85010. You might give it a shot. And I've got two of these booklets here. I got one in 79 and one in 82. And this is, again, Lord's Covenant Church, America's Promise Broadcast, Post Office Box 5334, Phoenix, Arizona. I think if you went to America's Promise Broadcast, you might find a web page. Lord's Covenant Church, you might find a web page. I don't know. P.O. Box 5334, Phoenix, Arizona, 85010. Book's 30 years old, but let me tell you, there's anything that's changed here. It's still just as viable today as it was then. The outcome that we're witnessing is worse than it was then. For instance, the love of money is the root of all evil. We see that in 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. And then there's a couple of statutes that he starts off with. He says, now if you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer, neither shall you lay upon him usury. That's in Exodus 22, verse 25. That's an economic law. It's against the law to charge usury. Charge interest on a loan. Take no usury of him or increase. You shall not give him your money upon usury. You see that in Leviticus 25, verses 36 and 37. And unto your brother you shall not lend upon usury, that the Eternal your God may bless you. That's Deuteronomy 23, 20. Now, in the early church, any interest on debt was considered usury. Read below to see what interest or usury on debts, a violation of God's law, is doing to America. Now, we Americans have decided that we don't want to follow the usury law in the Scripture. We want to borrow money from the bankers, and we want to pay interest on that money called the national debt. It's a choice that we had to make, and it's a choice that we have made past tense. And we have now gotten a result from that. And we're going to take a look at the result, and if you like it, stick with the program. See how simple that is? Now, here's our national debt as of March 26, 1977. So I'm going to go back in time here a little bit, take a look at the history of America and our debt, and then we'll take a look at it today and how it's growing, and then we'll just ask you the question, well, what do you think of that? If you like it, stick with it. Now, in 1901, the national debt of the United States was less than $1 billion, and then it stayed at less than $1 billion until we got into World War I. Then it jumped up to $25 billion. So we went to war, and we spent a little time, effort, and energy over there defeating the Germans, remember, in Europe. And when we got through with World War I, our national debt had jumped by 2,500%, from $1 billion in 1901 to $25 billion. Then between 1918 and 1941, on the eve of World War II, the national debt just about doubled again from $25 billion to $49 billion. So when we got into the Depression, and then Franklin Roosevelt said we need to spend our way to prosperity, we doubled our debt again now from $25 to $50 billion. Between 1942 and 1952, the debt went from $72 billion to $265 billion. That's what it cost to fight World War II and Korea. In 1962, it was $303 billion. 8 years later, in 1970, it was $383 billion. Between 1971 and 76, it rose from $409 billion to $631 billion. And the estimated debt at the end of this year, this is 1977, will be $727 billion. Next year, it's expected to top $800 billion, having nearly doubled in the past 8 years. And if the present trend continues, and there is no evidence that it will not continue, we can expect the national debt to nearly double again within the next 6 to 8 years. By then, the interest on the debt alone should be in the neighborhood of $400 billion a year. Eventually, the government will own nothing, the people will own nothing, and the banks will own everything. The banks will own everything. That's where we're headed. Now, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them, around the banks, will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. That statement was made by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said that. He said, if you allow these banks now and the corporations that grow up around them free reign. They're going to take over everything. I'm here to report to you that that is already past tense. They have taken over nearly everything. They don't own 100%, but they're out around 90, something like that. I saw some numbers the other day, and it said something like the corporations here in America, the top 500 corporations in America, what do you call it? Fortune 500. Those corporations own about 90% of all of the wealth of America, and all of the people of America own 10%, which fulfills Thomas Jefferson's prophecy, doesn't it? Now, history reveals nations can be conquered by the use of one or more of three methods. The most common method of conquest is by war, and in time, though, this method usually fails because the captives hate the captors, and they rise up and drive them out if they can. Much force is needed to maintain control, making it very expensive for the conquering nation to make any real profit or to make money off of conquering nations by war. The second method is by religion, where men are convinced that they must give their captors part of their earnings as obedience to God. Such a captivity is vulnerable to philosophical exposure or by overthrow by armed force, since religion by its nature lacks military force to regain control, once its captives become disillusioned. Now, the third method can be called economic conquest. Economic conquest takes place when nations are placed under tribute, without the use of visible force or coercion, so that the victims do not realize that they have been conquered. Tribute is collected from them in the form of legal debts and taxes, and the people believe that they're paying it for their own good, or for the good of others, or to protect all of them from some enemy. Their captors become their benefactors and their protectors. And although this is the slowest to impose, it's often quite long-lasting, as the captives do not see any military force arrayed against them. Their religion is left more or less intact. They have freedom to speak and to travel. They participate in elections for their rulers. Without realizing it, they have been captured. They have been conquered. And the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to their captors and make the conquest complete. Now, in 1900, the average American worker paid very few taxes and had very little debt. But last year, payments on debts and taxes took more than half of what the average American earned. Now, is it just possible that a form of conquest has taken place and has been imposed upon the people of America? Well, read the following pages and decide for yourself, and we'll take it up later on. Now, this study on money is not copyrighted, and it may be reproduced in whole or in part for the purpose of helping the American people. Americans living in what is called the richest nation on earth seem always to be short of money. Wives are working in unprecedented numbers today. Husbands hope for overtime hours to earn more or to take part-time jobs evenings and weekends. Children look for odd jobs for spending money. The family debt climbs higher. Psychologists say one of the biggest causes of family quarrels and breakups, divorce, is arguments over money. And much of this trouble can be traced to our present debt money system. Very few Americans realize why Christian statesmen wrote into our Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution that Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. They did this, as we will show, in hope that it would prevent love of money from destroying the republic that they had just founded. We'll see how subversion of Article 1 has brought on us the evil of which God's Word has warned. Now, money is man's only creation. Economists use the term create when speaking of the process by which money comes into existence. Now, creation means making something that did not exist before. Lumbermen make boards out of trees. Workers build houses from that lumber. Factories manufacture automobiles from metal, glass, and other materials. But in all of these, they did not create. They only changed the existing materials into a more usable and therefore a more valuable form. This is not so with money. Here and here alone, man actually creates something out of nothing. He creates a piece of paper of very little value, and it is printed so that it is worth a piece of lumber. With different figures, it can buy the automobile or even the house. Its value has been created in the truest meaning of the word. Money creating is very profitable. And as is seen by the above, money is very cheap to make. And whoever does this creating of money in a nation can make a tremendous profit. Builders work hard to make a profit of 5% above their cost to build a house. Automakers sell their cars for 1 or 2% above the cost of manufacture, and it's considered good business. But money manufacturers have no limit on their profits, since a few cents will print a $1 bill, or a $100 bill, or a $10,000 bill. It doesn't cost any more to print a $10,000 bill than it does to print a $1 bill. And that profit is part of our story. But first, let us consider another unique characteristic of this thing called money, the love of which is the root of all evil. Adequate money supply is needed. So an adequate supply of money is indispensable to civilized society. We could forego many other things, but without money, industry would grind to a halt. Farms would become only self-sustaining units. Surplus food would disappear. Jobs requiring the work of more than one man or one family would remain undone. Shipping and large movements of goods would cease. Hungry people would plunder and kill to stay alive. And all government except family or tribe would cease to function. Now, you say that's an overstatement? Well, no, not at all. You see, money is the blood of civilized society. Money is the means by which all commercial trade, except simple barter, is done. It is the measure. It is the instrument by which one product is sold and another is purchased. If you remove money or even reduce the supply of money below that which is necessary to carry on the current levels of trade, commerce, business, and industry, the results are catastrophic. As an example, we need only look at America's depression back in the 1930s. We call that the banker's depression of the 1930s. In 1930, America did not lack industrial capacity, fertile farmland, skilled and willing workers, or industrious farm families. It had a very extensive and highly efficient transportation system in railroads, road networks, and inland and ocean waterways. Communications between regions of the country and localities were the best in the world. Utilizing telephone, teletype, radio, and a well-operated government mail system, no war had ravaged the cities or the countryside. There had been no pestilence weakening the population, nor had any famine stalked the land. The United States of America in 1930 lacked only one thing. It lacked an adequate supply of money to carry on trade and commerce. Now, in the early 1930s, bankers, the only source of this new money and credit, deliberately refused loans to industries, stores, and farms. Payments on existing loans were required, however, and money rapidly disappeared out of circulation. Goods were available to be purchased. Jobs were waiting to be done. But the lack of money brought the nation to a standstill. By this simple ploy, America was put into a depression, and the greedy bankers took possession of hundreds of thousands of farms, homes, and business properties. The people were told times are hard, and money is short. So not understanding the system, the people were cruelly robbed of their earnings, their savings, and their property. Money for peace, no. Money for war, you bet. World War II ended the Depression, and the same bankers who, in the early 1930s, had no loans for peacetime houses, food, and clothing, suddenly had unlimited billions of dollars to lend for army barracks, K-rations, uniforms, trucks, and armaments. The nation that in 1934 couldn't produce food for sale suddenly could produce bombs to send free to Germany and Japan. Now, with the sudden increase in money, the people were hired, farms sold their produce, factories went to two shifts, mines were reopened, and the Great Depression was suddenly over. Some politicians were blamed for this, and others took credit for ending it. The truth is, it was the lack of money caused by the bankers brought on the Depression, and an adequate money supply ended it. And the people were never told that simple truth, and in this article, I'm going to endeavor to show how these same bankers who control our money and credit have used their control to plunder America and to place us in bondage and national captivity. Now, the power to coin and regulate money. When we can see the disastrous results of an artificially created shortage of money, we can better understand why our founding fathers, who understood both money and the laws of God, insisted on placing the power to create money and the power to control that money only in the hands of the federal Congress. They believed, they understood, that all citizens should share in the profits of its creation, and therefore the national government must be the only creator of money. Our founding fathers further believed that all citizens of whatever state or territory or station in life would benefit by an adequate and a stable currency, and therefore the national government must also be by law the only controller of the value of that money. Now, since the federal Congress was the only legislative body subject to all the citizens at the ballot box, it was, to their minds, the only safe depository of so much profit and so much power. They wrote it out in the simple but all-inclusive, Congress shall have power to coin money and to regulate the value thereof. Now, how the people lost control of that to the Federal Reserve is another story. Instead of the constitutional method of creating our money and putting it into circulation, we now have an entirely unconstitutional system. This has resulted in almost disastrous conditions, as we will see. Now, since our money was handled both legally and illegally before 1913, we shall consider only the years following 1913, since from that year on all of our money has been created and issued by an illegal method that will eventually destroy the United States of America if it is not changed. Prior to 1913, America was a very prosperous, powerful, and growing nation, at peace with its neighbors, and the envy of the world. But in December of 1913, Congress, with many members away for the Christmas holidays, passed what has since been known as the Federal Reserve Act. For the full story of how this infamous legislation was forced through our Congress, read Conquest or Consent by W.B. Vinard. But omitting the burdensome details, it simply authorized the establishment of a Federal Reserve Corporation with a board of directors, that's called the Federal Reserve Bank Board, to run that institution, and the United States was divided into 12 Federal Reserve districts. This simple but terrible law completely removed from Congress the right to create money or to have any control over its creation, and it gave that function to the Federal Reserve Corporation. This was done with appropriate fanfare and propaganda that this would remove money from politics. They didn't say, and therefore from the people's control, and prevent boom and bust from hurting our citizens. The people were not told then, and they most still do not know now, that the Federal Reserve Corporation is a private corporation which is owned and controlled by bankers, and therefore is operated for the financial gain and benefit of those bankers over the people rather than for the good of the people. And the word federal was used distinctly and intentionally to deceive the people into believing that it was a government institution, when in fact it is a private bank. Now, more disastrous than Pearl Harbor was this event. Since that day of infamy, more disastrous to us than Pearl Harbor, this small group of privileged people who lend us our money have now accrued to themselves all of the profits of printing our money and more. Since 1913, they have created tens of billions of dollars in money and credit, which as their own personal property, they then lend to our government and to you and me and our people at interest. And in this way, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And it became the secret policy of our national government. An example of the process of creation and its conversion to people's debt will aid you and I in understanding it. Well, let me pause right there, boys and girls, put my arrow here in the margin, and let me give you a mid-course reminder here that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about billions for the bankers, and we've been looking at this thing of the conquest of America without the firing of a shot. Nobody's taking us into national captivity, not by war, not by religion, but they've done it by the use of money. And we were told in the scripture there are 17 of these economic laws. One of these laws is don't practice usury and interest. Well, we didn't do that, and we haven't been practicing these 17 economic laws, and there's an outcome that comes from that. When we get over here to chapter 7 in this series of program, we'll take a look at these 17 economic laws, and I'll show you that as soon as you and I, that's just Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, practice these 17 rules, 17 laws, we can divorce ourselves from the bankers and let the other 300 million Americans go into national captivity and go into poverty. These 17 laws from the scripture are designed to make money, designed to make profit and gain. They are designed for prosperity. And when we Americans practiced those 17 laws from 1787 to 1933, we became the wealthiest, most powerful, prestigious nation in the world, militarily, economically, and politically. And when we turned our backs on those 17 laws and we started practicing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, we got a different result. That's the way the game is played. You get the results based upon the way you play the game. And we've played the game to produce poverty. So that's what we've got. If you want to play the game to produce profit and success, then we need to change back to the formula that we were using that produced all of the wealth in the first place. It doesn't take rocket scientists or rocket science to figure that out. Now, they print it, and we borrow it, and then we pay them interest. So let's start with the need for money. See, the federal government, having spent more than it's taken from its citizens in taxes, needs, for the sake of illustration, $1 billion. Since it does not have $1 billion in money, and Congress has given away its authority to create this $1 billion in money, then the government must go to the creators of money, the corporation, the Federal Reserve, for the $1 billion. But the Federal Reserve is a private corporation and doesn't just give its money away. These bankers are willing to deliver $1 billion in money or credit to the federal government in exchange for the government's agreement to pay it back with interest. So Congress authorizes the Treasury Department to print $1 billion in United States bonds, which are then delivered to the Federal Reserve bankers. And they say, well, sure, we will print and lend you $10 billion in exchange for $10 billion in interest-bearing bonds. See how simple that is? Now, the Federal Reserve then pays the cost of printing the $1 billion, which is about $1,000, and it makes the exchange. So they create $1 billion out of thin air. So they make $1 billion, plus they get paid the interest. And so they make the $1 billion plus interest at a cost of $1,000. The government then uses the money to pay its obligations. What are the results of this fantastic transaction? Well, $1 billion in government bills are paid all right, but the government has now indebted the people to the bankers for the $1 billion on which the people must now pay interest. Tens of thousands of such transactions have taken place since 1913, so that now, by the 1980s, the U.S. government is indebted to the bankers for more than $1 trillion, on which the people are now paying more than $100 billion a year in interest alone, with no hope of ever paying off the principal. And supposedly, our children and following generations are going to pay this forever and forever and forever. And there's more. Now, you may say, well, this is terrible, and yes, it is, but we've only shown you part of the sordid story. It gets worse. Under this criminal system, those United States bonds have now become assets of the banks in the Federal Reserve System, assets which they then can use as reserves to create even more credit to lend. Current reserve requirements allow them to use that $1 billion worth of bonds to create another $15 billion in new credit to lend to states, municipalities, and to you and I as individuals and businesses. Now, added to the original $1 billion, they could have $16 billion of created credit out in loans, paying them interest, with their only cost being $1,000 for the original printing of the original $1 billion. Now, since the U.S. Congress has not issued constitutional money since 1863, more than 100 years now, in order for the people to have money to carry on trade and commerce, we are now forced to borrow this created credit from the monopoly bankers and then pay them the usury interest that they demand. But that's not all of the story. There's more. In addition to this vast wealth drawn to them through this almost unlimited usury, the bankers who control the money at the top are able to approve or disapprove large loans to large and successful corporations to the extent that refusal of a loan will bring about a reduction in the price of that corporation's stock or what it sells for on the stock exchange market. After depressing the price, the banker's agents buy large blocks of this cheap stock, after which the sometimes multi-million dollar loan is approved. Then the stock rises. Then, after the stock rises, it is then sold for a profit. This is control and money manipulation of the stock market. In this manner, billions of dollars are made with just the stocks alone, by manipulating the loans to the corporations and the value of the stock. The bankers can make billions more by simply buying and selling stock, because they know when the stock is going to go down and when to buy, and they know when loans are going to be made and the stock is going to rise and then sell. This practice is so refined today that the Federal Reserve Board need only announce to the newspapers an increase or a decrease in their rediscount rate. That will send stocks up or send stocks down as they wish. Now, using this method since 1913, the bankers and their agents have purchased secret or open control of every large corporation in America. And then, using that control of those multinational corporations, they then force those corporations to borrow huge sums of money from their banks, so that corporation earnings are siphoned off in the form of interest to those banks. This then leaves very little as actual profits, which can be paid as dividends to the shareholders, and explains why stock prices are so depressed, while the banks reap billions in interest from corporate loans. In effect, then, the bankers get almost all of the profits produced in America, while individual stockholders are left holding the bag. Now, the millions of working families of America are now indebted to the few thousand banking families for twice the assessed value of the entire United States of America. That's right. You and I, the citizens of America, are the underwriters of this debt. And this debt now is more than double the entire value of the country, all of its businesses, all of its land. And these banking families obtained all of that debt against us for just the cost of the paper, the ink, and the bookkeeping. Now, the interest amount is never created. The only way this new money, which is not really true money, but is credit representing a debt, the way that goes into circulation in America is when it's borrowed from the bankers. So when the state and the people borrow large sums, we seem to prosper. However, the bankers create only the amount of the principal of each loan. They never create the extra amount needed to pay the interest. Therefore, all of this new money never equals the new debt added. The amounts needed to pay the interest on the loans is not created, and therefore it does not exist. So under this kind of system, there are new debts, and these new debts always exceed the new money, no matter how much or how little is borrowed. The total debt increasingly outstrips the amount of money available to pay that debt. And the people can never pay the debt, and they can never get out of debt. An example will show the viciousness of this usury debt system with its built-in shortage of money. This comes, by the way, from the Babylonian mystery religion. It goes back thousands of years to Babylon. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, $50,000 is borrowed. Well, then $263,941 must be paid back. That's right, boys and girls. When you borrow $50,000 to buy a new home, $263,941 has to be paid back. So when a citizen goes to a banker to borrow $50,000 to purchase a home or a farm, the bank clerk has the borrower agree to pay back the loan plus interest at 17.5% interest for 30 years. The borrower must agree to pay $733.17 a month for a total of $263,941.20. The clerk then requires the citizen to assign to the banker the right of ownership of the property if the borrower does not make the required payments. The bank clerk then gives the borrower a $50,000 check or a $50,000 deposit slip, creating the borrower's checking account with $50,000. The borrower then writes checks to the builder, subcontractors, and so on, who in turn write checks. $50,000 of new checkbook money is thereby added to money in circulation. However, and this is the fatal flaw in this usury system, the only new money created and put into circulation is the amount of the loan, that is the $50,000. You see, boys and girls, the money to pay that $263,000 interest has not been created, and therefore was not added to the money in circulation, and therefore can never be paid off. Even so, this borrower and those who follow him in ownership of the property must earn and take out of circulation $263,941. That's over $200,000 more than he put into circulation when he first borrowed that original $50,000 to build the house. And by the way, it is this interest which cheats all of the families out of nicer homes. And it's not that they can't afford them. It is because the banker's usury forces them to pay for five homes in order to get one. and that's at 17% interest in 1980. Boys and girls, at 6% interest, you buy two houses. One house for you and one for the banker, plus $17,000 on that same $50,000 house. At 8% interest, you buy one house for you and two for the banker. How do you like that for a plan? Now remember, there are 17 rules, 17 laws, in which God now has told us, don't do that. Now, of course, you and I are smarter than God, and we know how to cut a fat hog in the back. And that's what we've been doing, cutting a fat hog in the back. Now, every new loan puts the same process into operation, and each borrower adds a small sum to the total money supply when he borrows that money, but the payments on the loan because of the interest then deduct a much larger sum from the total money supply. So the total supply of money in circulation goes down. Now, when we're on the gold standard, new money is brought into circulation by miners who are out there digging the gold out of the ground. There is no usury, and there is no debt. The gold is worth the same amount as the labor that it took to get it out of the ground. So the miner is actually being paid for his labor by digging the gold out of the ground, and he spends it into circulation, and he buys boards and buys materials and builds a house. When he gets through, his labor, digging the $50,000 out of the ground, pays for the house. He now owns the house free and clear, and there's no debt against it, and there's no interest, and there's no usury, and there's no debt, and there's no inflation. That's the beauty of the hard money system that we got from God, our Creator. But it produces no profits for the parasites called bankers, lawyers, preachers, and businessmen. And these four professions want to make a profit. And they want to make that profit off of all of us. And so these four professions, bankers, lawyers, preachers, and businessmen, team up together. And they say, well, how can we do that? Well, we need to produce money. When we need to persuade the people that they need to borrow our money. So they appeal to our vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, and they persuade us to borrow their money and pay their interest. That's a trap. When we enter into it, there's no way out. Now, the way out is when you lose all of your property, and that's what's going on in America today. All of you homeowners out there that have a debt against your houses are going to lose it. How's that? All of you people who are practicing or participating in usury and interest by buying stocks and bonds and putting it into your 401k, you're going to lose it. And the sooner you lose it, the sooner we can get back to making a real living and making real profits. But of course, you don't want to lose your 401k. You don't want to lose your house. You don't want to lose your car. You don't want to lose your job. You don't want to go back to square one. You don't want to square this up and start over again and do it right. So the banker said, see, if you don't bail us out now, we're not going to lend you any money. And this whole thing will collapse, and you'll lose everything. And so you said, well, okay, let's vote for Barack Obama. And between George Bush and Barack Obama, you have what's now called quantitative easing. That's called inflation. We're going to print this money, put it into circulation, put you deeper in debt. We're going to use this debt to bail you out. Boys and girls, this debt is what got you into this jam to start with, and you ain't getting out of this jam, you ain't getting out of this hole by borrowing more money. And you can't pay it back. There isn't enough money out there to pay it all back. That's why the foreclosure process is going on. And that's why the bankers are going to end up with all of it. Well, except for those of you out there that aren't in debt. So one of the first things we tell a student in business school here at the law school is we got to get you out of debt. You cannot make money until you get to zero COD. And most of you people out there, you're not anywhere close to zero COD. You're at minus $200,000 on your mortgage. You're at minus $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 on your car or cars. You're at minus $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 on your consumer loans for your furniture, big screen TV, and all those toys that you've got. You can't make any money, and you can't pay off those debts. It ain't going to happen. Not in your lifetime. Not in your children's lifetime. And this is why we call this process credit debt serfdom. Some people call it credit debt slavery, but it's actually, slavery is the wrong term to use. Slavery is a legal term, a legal word. But serfdom is a correct word. Or credit debt bondage is a correct word. It's bond servitude is what it boils down to. Can you get out? Sure, sure, you can get out. But you cannot get out with the toys. And it's like the story of the little rhesus monkey. I always tell my students, there's this cute little monkey lives in the out in the jungle. And the way they catch him is very very novel. They put a birdcage out here in the forest. And they suspend a peanut inside the birdcage. Just one peanut. Just hang it in the middle of the cage. And the little rhesus monkey comes up, and he sees that peanut hanging down inside the cage, and he can reach in through the bars. To reach in through the bars, he has to hold his hand flat, extend all of his fingers out and his thumb straight up in the air. And by doing that, his hand will fit between the bars. He reaches in, and then he grasps the peanut. And now he has the peanut firmly in his fist. Now his fist is about 4 times wider than his hand when it's extended straight up. And his fist will not fit through those bars. You can test it. You can test it. Just hold your hand out and see how flat it is. Now double it up into a fist, and it's about 4 times wider. Now the little rhesus monkey has hold of the peanut, that's the prize, and he goes to escape, and he cannot get his fist through the bars. Now the little monkey actually is not trapped. All he has to do to get away is to let go of the peanut. And as soon as he lets go of the peanut, he can straighten his hand up. And it'll be flat, 25% of the size of his fist, and he can withdraw his hand from the bars and run away. Boys and girls, no rhesus monkey has ever been known to let go of the peanut. You don't even have to throw a net over the little monkey. You just walk up and pick him up. And then you open the door, and then you have to take his hand off of the peanut. You got to force his hand open and take the peanut away from him. Then you can bring his hand through the bars, but now you've got hold of the little monkey. And the bankers have simply used the same technique with us. They put the money out there, and no American has ever been known to let go of the money, let go of the peanut. Isn't that just special? Well, I'm out of time again, children. We've got to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.